Live from the historic parsonage of 19th century gospel minister George Norcross in downtown Carlisle, Pennsylvania. It's Iron Sharpens Iron, a radio platform on which pastors, Christian scholars, and theologians address the burning issues facing the church and the world today. Proverbs 27, verse 17 tells us, "Iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another." Matthew Henry said that in this passage, quote, "We are cautioned to take heed whom we converse with, and directed to have in view in conversation to make one another wiser and better." It is our hope that this goal will be accomplished over the next hour, and we hope to hear from you, the listener, with your own questions. Now here's our host, Chris Arnson.
Good afternoon, Cumberland County, Pennsylvania, Lake City, Florida, and the rest of humanity living on the planet Earth who are listening via live streaming at ironsharpensironradio.com. This is Chris Arnson, your host of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio, wishing you all a happy Wednesday on this 6th day of December 2017. I'm very excited about this program. The day after the Supreme Court heard arguments in regard to the now infamous gay wedding cake controversy involving the Masterpiece Bakery, and it is providential that we have this program today because I did not even know that that was going to happen yesterday, and it's going to be interesting to see how things develop from there. But today we have two guests. We have a returning guest, and we have a first-time guest. We have Scott Lively, who's been on this program a number of times. And we have joining him today for the very first time, Kevin Abrams. Scott Lively is a Christian attorney and pastor, and Kevin Abrams is an Orthodox Jew. And together they wrote The Pink Swastika, Homosexuality in the Nazi Party. And we're going to be discussing its relevance in the 21st century America. And it's my honor and privilege to welcome you to Iron Sharpens Iron Radio, Scott Lively and Kevin Abrams.
Oh, very good to be here, Chris.
Yeah, thank you, Chris, for having us on the show.
Yes, and Kevin, it's a delight to have you on for the very first time ever. This book, The Pink Swastika, Homosexuality in the Nazi Party, is now entering into its fifth edition. And I want to hold the attention of our listeners because some folks might immediately think that we are a bunch of nuts, even discussing something like this. And I just want to read some of the commendations that this book has received over the years. First of all, we have Dr. Judith Reisman of the Institute for Media Education. "As a Jewish scholar who lost hundreds of her family in the Holocaust, I welcome the Pink Swastika as courageous and timely. Lively and Abrams reveal the reigning gay history as revisionist and expose the super male German homosexuals for what they were, Nazi brutes, not Nazi victims." And we have William Norman Grigg, my dear friend, who was the former senior editor of New American Magazine, and he just went home to be with the Lord after a heart attack, I believe, that was subsequent to an illness he developed. And William is a dear friend, and I had him on this program quite a number of times. He was a Mormon convert to Christianity, and he was known by his friends as Thesaurus Rex because of the fact that he had a computer-like mind when it came to vocabulary and synonyms and antonyms and so on. But my dear friend William Norman Grigg said, "The Pink Swastika is a tremendously valuable book, replete with impressive documentation presented in a compelling fashion." And Stan Goodenough, Middle East Intelligence Digest, says, "The Pink Swastika exposes numerous lies and tears away many myths. Essential reading, it is a formidable boulder cast into the path of the onrushing homosexual express." And then we have Dr. Mordecai Nissan, Hebrew University of Jerusalem. "The Pink Swastika is a powerful exposure of pre-World War II Germany and its quest for reviving and imitating a Hellenistic, paganistic idea of homoeroticism and militarism. And then R.J. Rushdoony of the Chalcedon Foundation, he is well known to a considerably large portion of my audience. He is also with the Lord now. R.J. Rushdoony said, Lively and Abrams call attention to what Hitlerism really stood for. Abortion, euthanasia, hatred of Jews, and very emphatically, homosexuality. This many of us knew in the 1930s. It was common knowledge, but now it is denied. Then we have Norma Seville of the News of All Israel, a treasury of knowledge for anyone who wants to know what really happened during the Jewish Holocaust. And then we have Colonel Ronald Ray, former U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense. Scott Lively and Kevin Abrams have done America a great service. John Hulley, former senior economist of the World Bank. A landmark book for those who have trouble understanding Hitler, the Holocaust, previous books, and movies, however high their quality, have left me mystified as to how the Nazi leaders could have done the things they did. This short book gets closer to the truth than anything I know of. And then last but not least, Dr. Howard Hurwitz of the Family Defense Council said, The pink swastika, homosexuality in the Nazi Party, is a thoroughly researched, eminently readable demolition of the gay myth symbolized by the pink triangle that the Nazis were anti-homosexual. The deep roots of homosexuality in the Nazi Party are brilliantly exposed. I thought it was very valuable to read all of those. People might be wondering why I was going on reading all of those. Because of the fact of the reason I just opened up the program with. People think that you are nuts when you bring this up. The fact that the Nazi Party was founded largely by, if not entirely by, homosexuals, and that that element carried through in its leadership throughout the entirety of the party, and even has existed amongst American Nazi parties and so on. But if you could, both of you, I'll start with Scott. We've discussed this before, but if you could give us an abbreviated history as to how you developed an interest in this to begin with, and then how, Kevin, you also simultaneously developed an interest in this, and how you two met and collaborated on this book.
Well, yes, actually, I think Kevin had been working on this theme for quite some time before we met. My interest was piqued in it because I was the communications director for the Oregon Citizens Alliance, and we had a ballot measure back in 1992 to amend the Oregon State Constitution to stop special rights based on sexual orientation. And the campaign that the left waged against us in that state was centered on the theme that people who oppose gay rights are like Nazis. And I thought my job at the time, I believed the common wisdom that the Nazis were anti-homosexual, and I thought my job as communications director was to distinguish between the Nazis' hate-based opposition and our, biblical and cultural and sociological opposition to homosexuality. And then one day, in the middle of the campaign, this sort of wild-eyed Mormon guy, kind of reminiscent of Doc Brown, from Back to the Future. Really, I mean, seriously, he was a very interesting character, and he came in. He said, "They got it all backwards. It's the Nazis were all homosexuals." And then he had this set of handwritten notes, like 20 or 30 pages of notes of things of citations he had copied from various books. He's sort of a researcher, and. And I nodded politely, and I glanced at it, thanked him, and then sent him on his way, and then stuck it in a file and forgot about it.
Because you also had the guttural reaction, like most people, that it was nuts.
Yeah, that's right. That I thought this guy's a nut. And then we went through that election cycle. We came pretty close, but we failed. And then in the next election cycle, we were doing a series of city and county measures based on the same language. And when we got to Marion County, the capital, where the capital seat is, Salem, the state capital is in Marion County, the director of the opposition campaign wrote a letter to the local newspaper, the Salem Statesman Journal, saying he'd just returned from a visit to Germany where he'd been to Dachau, and what an amazing similarity there was between the Oregon Citizens Alliance and the Nazi Party. And I said, ah, that's it. I have had enough. I remembered this sheaf of papers. I went into my files. I pulled it out. And then for the first time, I really read it. And my jaw dropped to the desk when I realized that I'd been, sitting on a gold mine here or really a powder keg of dynamite. And then I wrote a guest opinion, to the newspaper, and it set off this incredible firestorm of controversy. It went back and forth for about 6 weeks every day. And the first one triggered a response from a history professor at Western College, and then, just exploded from there. And it was so significant that the local professor of rhetoric at Willamette University wrote a paper about the exchange. He used the exchange as the basis for a paper that he delivered that summer in Amsterdam on the effective use of rhetoric. And so in the midst of all this, as this fire is just raging about this topic, Carol Patrone, a Catholic researcher in OCA, who knows Kevin, got us together on the telephone, said, you guys got to talk to each other, because she knew that he had been researching. I'll let him talk about his own background on this. And then in that conversation, the first time we ever met by phone, we decided to write a book together. And that's where the pink swastika comes from.
Well, Kevin, if you could give us your own background and the thing that ignited your own interest in this.
Well, I've been doing research, Holocaust research and Second World War history studies for quite a number of years. I started probably as far back as 1985. And one of the paths that I went down was this whole, question of homosexuals being persecuted alongside the Jewish people during the Holocaust. And being a person who tends to empathize with the victim, I kind of embraced, like Scott, I embraced the idea of homosexual victimization during the Nazi era, somewhat similar to what the Jewish people experienced during the Holocaust. But I kept on running up against this contradiction that some of the key figures within the Nazi movement were actually homosexuals themselves. In fact, the more I looked into it, the more I found evidence of homosexuality amongst the leadership and many of the top leaders of the Nazi movement in the early days, especially like Ernst Röhm and Edmund Heinz and Gerhard Rosbach and so forth, who were all leading figures in the early round shirt movement, which were the stormtrooper or the street brawler.
Yeah, they were the ones that are infamously known for Kristallnacht, who were smashing the windows of Jewish-owned stores and businesses and terrorizing Jewish citizens.
That's right. And so I looked at that and I said, well, I asked myself that question because, of course, as an investigative journalist or as a lay psychohistorian that wants to understand the who and why of history, we have a lot of books, like, for instance, John Hulley endorses our book, a former senior economist for the World Bank, and says that this book explains more succinctly to him why the Holocaust could have happened than any other book that he'd ever read, even though, they had been extremely well documented. And, of course, most historical works are all about the what, when, and where, and deal very little, if any, with the who and the why. The what, where, and when is the framing of history, but the who and the why is the contents, is the picture, is the centerpiece. It's like, the question questions that we ask about ourselves or by about other people is, who am I? You know, maybe a question that we ask that we grow into throughout the course of a lifetime. Who am I and why am I here? So the who and the why became critical aspects of my investigation into Nazi history and World War II history. And increasingly, I ran up against this wall where I could no longer reconcile the victimization of homosexuals by the Nazis with the evidence that the leading Nazis were actually militant, what we would probably refer to as militant gay pederasts, because yeah. they were more of a Ubermenschian or butch form of homosexist, and they preferred young boys, and there were many scandals having to do with young boys being sexually molested at the Brown House in Berlin, and even when
by Nazis, by Nazis, you mean?
Yes, that's right. Well, by the brown shirts. Later on in Nazi history or National Socialist history, there emerged, of course, the SS. And the SS became Hitler's personal bodyguard, the brown shirts were a power unto themselves that reached some, you know, close to 4 million members at one point. And they were made up originally of disbanded freebooter movements from World War One, and they kind of became a law unto themselves. And one of the leading freebooter movements, of course, was led by a fellow by the name of Gerhard Rossbach, who was a homosexist and a pederast. And he, that's from him that we derive the brown shirt. That was Gerhard Rossbach. We hear very little about Gerhard Rossbach, but it was a key figure in the rise of the early Nazi movement.
And what is a freebooter movement? What is a freebooter? I don't know what that means.
There were about 150 disbanded military units from World War One, from the German Reichswehr, the German army. And they became a law unto themselves, and they just basically they became like gangs, you know, more or less. I just disbanded soldiers from World War One, basically units of soldiers.
I can add to that too, because this is something I've talked a lot about in interviews with this, because people are very curious about how this could have happened. It's really, remember, the Treaty of Versailles had limited the German nation to 100,000 men in arms, and that put an enormous number of soldiers out of work, and this whole sort of nationalist movement, very heavily militaristic, the military-industrial complex was still intact, but it had been defeated. And the officers among this group, they organized these men into, you know, sports clubs, and, you know, some of them were like gangs and et cetera. One of the terms used for them was Freikorps, or free corps, you know, independent, you know, free from the military corps. But they had to use the junior officers of the former German military as leaders of these groups that were really, it was a cover to keep the military together and in violation of the Treaty of Versailles. And one of them was the most important to our story, and that is Gerhard Rossbach's Rossbachbund, which was exclusively homosexual, and they were also the distinct from all the other Freikorps, because they dressed in the brown uniforms of the, you see, Germany had lost its colonies in Africa during the First World War, and so the German surplus stores were full of these leftover uniforms, and so Rossbach had his men dressed in these. All the rest of them were dressed in gray, the standard German uniform, but so they became known as the brown shirts, and so the earliest brown shirts were all homosexuals.
Yeah, in fact, I remember reading in your book that the regular army, the regular German army, had a nickname for them, the Brown Fairies, because they knew that this was a fact, that that they were known for their homosexual activity.
Yeah, and Kevin mentioned the Brown House. The Brown House was in Munich, the headquarters of the Brown Shirts, and they had wild parties. Everybody knew what was going on there. These were homosexual, extremely violent, militaristic guys. These are bully boys from the street. They would just beat people up, and they had wild homosexual orgies in the Brown House that were notorious. They were famous actually throughout Europe. It's one of the reasons why Mussolini hated Ernst Röhm so much, is because of the reputation that he had for what the Brown Shirts were doing, under his authority.
And
to that point, a very a semi-official Italian newspaper with the assassination of Chancellor Dollfuss in Austria, who was killed by Nazis, the newspaper Il Popolo reported that pederasts and assassins rule in Berlin. So there was a direct semi-official reference to the nature of the Nazi movement in one of these semi-official Italian newspapers, because Dollfuss was friendly with Mussolini, and Mussolini was quite upset when Dollfuss was assassinated by the Nazis. So it's going from there. We look at the Holocaust itself, and of course there was a more or less a civil war that began to emerge in my study between the two factions. And of course, since with Scott, we've further developed that theme, that there were two sides to the homosexual world in Germany. One was the Magnus Hirschfeld faction, who founded the Berlin Institute of Sexology and the Scientific Humanitarian Committee for the repeal of Section 175 of the German Penal Code, and the liberalization of laws as they related to homosexuality. And then the other side was the Bund für Menschenrecht, or the Society for Human Rights, which was the Nazi, more or less affiliated with the Nazi movement within which Ernst Röhm was a member. And basically they were militant gays, and they didn't buy this business about a woman in a man's body, which was what Magnus Hirschfeld was promoting, is that homosexuals were members of a third sex, and that they were actually women in men's bodies, but the militant, gay pederast, he saw himself as a superior type of Übermensch, and basically it was basically an aspect of the superior man.
Those on the butch side of the homosexual activist movement in Germany would have found it very offensive to be considered among the effeminate homosexuals and somehow born with a defect of some kind, that they were men born in women's bodies. They thought this was a gift or a sign of superiority in maleness, actually.
They had totally opposing opinions. So, actually, the Nazis referred to the effeminate homosexuals as emasculated gossips. So they saw the effeminate side of the homosexual world as being rather emasculated and weak, limp-wristed, so to speak. They wouldn't have liked Milo.
The other guy that's coming out now, that's being accused of being a white supremacist, another young man about the same age, that they represent a butch or a masculine alternative to the what's traditionally recognized as effeminate male homosexuality is really the identity of gay men in America, even though half of the homosexual population leans to the masculine side as opposed to the feminine side. That's what gets the attention, because they stand out. Anytime a man is acting like a woman, that's going to get a lot more attention than a man that's acting like a man and hiding his homosexuality at the same time.
Yeah, in fact, it's interesting. I wanted to just quickly bring up, and I'll let you continue your thought, but in case there are some people that are still listening with disbelief and shaking their heads, the very group that has Scott Lively on a list of the top hate groups of America, the Southern Poverty Law Center, which also has my friend Michael Brown on that list. But
I'm about to spit when you say that name there, Chris.
Excuse me?
I'm about to spit when you say that name.
But the very group that has you identified as a leader of a hate group, Southern Poverty Law Center, if you go to their website, splcenter.org, and you type in gay Nazis, you get a whole list of articles about gay Nazi groups that they are exposing. Just to read a brief portion of their section on that, Ku Klux Klansmen, neo-Nazis, Christian identity adherents, racist skinheads, and Odinists, along with your garden variety white supremacists, these are the people that populate America's radical right. They inhabit, by definition, the outermost fringes of our society. And then there are the gay neo-Nazis. Talk about a sect within a sect. The members of this tiny subculture on the radical right, mainly men who inhabit web chat rooms like Gay Aryan Resistance, just can't seem to get any respect. And then it goes on and on and on, quoting from these so-called gay Nazis and so on. So it's amazing that they would highlight you, Scott, as a leader of a hate group for bringing up something that existed in the earlier part of the 20th century, and they seem to believe it is completely appropriate to be exposing contemporary homosexual Nazis. It makes no sense that they would be so radically opposed to you and Kevin. And I'm not sure if they even identify Kevin, because they might think it's more politically incorrect to identify an Orthodox Jewish person in this way. But it is interesting, and I can only think that the only reason that they are attacking you is because they know that the form of Nazism that rose up in Germany in the early part of the 20th century resulted in the deaths of millions, and the contemporary neo-Nazi groups, although there may be some accounts of deaths and brutality, it's primarily just a hate speech involvement that they are known for. But if you want to comment on what I just said.
Well, I think the Southern Poverty Law Center is at the core of the hard left in America, and they're furious that what Kevin and I did when we published the first edition of the Pink Swastika back in 1995, we interrupted a second decade of propaganda attempting to create, fabricate a gay Holocaust equivalent to what happened to the Jews. The entire LGBT movement was using that as its basis for an appeal for sympathy. In fact, the symbol of the movement nationally was the inverted pink triangle, which in fact was used by the Nazis to designate homosexuals, who were relatively few in number in the work camps, not the death camps. And so when we came out with the pink swastika and we exposed the deep and wide roots of the Nazi Party in homosexuality itself, and then that was picked up by Orthodox rabbis across the country, then the gays had to stop using the pink triangle. They had to abandon it. That's when they shifted to using the rainbow as their symbol. And they were, they had invested an enormous amount of money and man hours into sort of building this, propaganda structure.
It was a victim narrative that they exploited politically.
Yes, in fact, I recall, and it's amazing, maybe it's not that amazing, but I cannot find this documentary anywhere on the internet today. Perhaps you guys can. But I remember clearly years ago that there was an HBO documentary that was produced and hosted by a professing homosexual, and who was also a homosexual activist, who launched a research journey to find out exactly what all the details were in regard to the persecution of homosexuals in the Nazi regime, And the man, the young man, I can clearly remember. At the end of the documentary, he actually admitted that the vast majority of homosexuals who died in the camps died of illness, that they were not targeted in any stretch of the imagination like the Jews were, and they were even given opportunities to be rehabilitated if they were arrested after the Nazis, to clean up their public relations, started to crack down and on the surface persecute homosexuals. They were given a chance to rehabilitate.
Breaking the sodomy laws. They were arrested for violating the sodomy laws that were on the books in Germany that were identical to the sodomy laws in the United States that people were being jailed for there. They weren't being herded like the Jews were,
right,
putting in concentration camps. They were just simply arrested by the police for violating laws that were commonplace around the whole world.
Yes, I hope that somebody can find that documentary, because I think that it may have been permanently removed from the archives of HBO because of the findings that this person had, and perhaps when they aired it, there was such a negative outcry. I'm only assuming at this point, because I can't find it. I can't find it anywhere. But we're going to go to a break right now. And if anybody would like to join us on the air, our email address is chrisarnzen@gmail.com, chrisarnzen@gmail.com. Please give us your first name, your city and state, and your country of residence if you live outside the USA. Please only remain anonymous if this involves a personal and private matter. And don't go away. God willing, we will be right back with Scott Lively and Kevin Abrams on the pink swastika, homosexuality, and the Nazi Party right after these messages from our sponsors.
Iron Sharpens Iron Radio is sponsored by Harvey Cedars, a year-round Bible conference and retreat center nestled on the Jersey Shore. Harvey Cedars offers a wide range of accommodations to suit groups up to 400. For generations, Christians have enjoyed gathering and growing at Harvey Cedars. Each year, thousands of high school and college students come and learn more about God's Word. An additional 9,000 come annually to Harvey Cedars as families, couples, singles, men, women, pastors, seniors, and missionaries. 90 miles from New York City, 70 miles from Philly, and 95 miles from Wilmington, and easily accessible, scores of notable Christian groups frequently plan conferences at Harvey Cedars, like the Navigators, InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, Campus Crusade, and the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals. Find Harvey Cedars on Facebook or at hcbible.org, hcbible.org. Call 609-494-5689, 609-494-5689. Harvey Cedars, where Christ finds people and changes lives.
Have you been blessed by Iron Sharpens Iron Radio? We remain on the air because of our faithful sponsors and because of listeners like you. There are four ways you can help. First, do you know potential sponsors who may wish to advertise their goods or services on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio? Second, whenever possible, purchase the products or use the services that our sponsors advertise. And then let them know that you heard about them on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. Thirdly, you can also donate to Iron Sharpens Iron Radio by going to our website at ironsharpensironradio.com and click support at the top of the page. But most importantly, keep Iron Sharpens Iron Radio in your prayers. We hope that Iron Sharpens Iron Radio blesses you for many years to come.
One sure way all Iron Sharpens Iron Radio listeners can help keep my show on the air is to support my advertisers. I know you all use batteries every day, so I'm urging you all from now on to exclusively use BatteryDepot.com for all your battery needs. At BatteryDepot.com, they're changing the status quo. They're flipping the script. They're sticking it to the man. In other words, They'd like to change the battery industry for good by providing an extensive inventory of top-of-the-line batteries that are uniformly new, dependable, and affordable. Ordering from BatteryDepot.com ensures you'll always get fresh out-of-the-box batteries you can count on to work properly at competitive prices. Whether you need batteries for cordless phones, cell phones, radios, PCs, laptops, tablets, baby monitors, hearing aids, smoke detectors, credit card readers, digital cameras, electronic cigarettes, GPSs, MP3 players, watches, or nearly anything else you own that needs batteries, go to BatteryDepot.com. Next day shipping available. All products protected by 30-day guarantees and 6-month warranties. Call 866-403-3768. That's 866-403-3768. Or go to BatteryDepot.com. That's BatteryDepot.com.
Hi, I'm Pastor Bill Shishko, inviting you to tune in to A Visit to the Pastor's Study every Saturday from 12 noon to 1 p.m. Eastern Time on WLIE Radio, www.wlie540am.com. We bring biblically faithful pastoral ministry to you, and we invite you to visit the pastor's study by calling in with your questions. Our time will be lively, useful, and I assure you, never dull. Join us this Saturday at 12 noon Eastern Time for a visit to the pastor's study, because everyone needs a pastor.
Hi, I'm Chris Arnzen, host of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio, here to tell you about an exciting offer from World Magazine, my trusted source for news from a Christian perspective. Try World at no charge for 90 days and get a free copy of R.C. Sproul's book, Relationship Between Church and State. I rely on World because I trust the reporting. I gain insight from the analysis, and World provides clarity to the news stories that really matter. I believe you'll also find World to be an invaluable resource to better understand critical topics with a depth that's simply not found in other media outlets. Armed with this coverage, World can help you to be a voice of wisdom in your family and your community. This trial includes bi-weekly issues of World Magazine, on-scene reporting from World Radio, and the fully shareable content of World Digital. Simply visit wmg.org/ironsharpens to get your World trial and Dr. Sproul's book all free. No obligation, with no credit card required. Visit World News Group at wng.org/ironsharpens today.
Welcome back. This is Chris Arnzen. If you just tuned us in, our two guests today are Scott Lively and Kevin Abrams. Scott is a Christian attorney and pastor, and Kevin Abrams is an Orthodox Jew and a journalist, and they have co-authored a book that is now entering into its fifth edition, The Pink Swastika, Homosexuality in the Nazi Party. We're discussing that book and also its relevance in 21st century America. If you'd like to join us on the air, our email address for questions is chrisarnzen@gmail.com, chrisarnzen@gmail.com. Please give us your first name, city and state, and country of residence if you live outside the USA. Please only remain anonymous if your question involves a personal and private matter. And let's pick up, Kevin, where you left off, if you wanted to continue a thread of thought there, because I do want to eventually, very soon, get to the root of the ideology of the Nazi Party, why this band, this small band, which originally began as a small band, of men involved in homosexual pederasty, formed this movement, and was the homosexual activity that they were involved in inconsequential to their ideology? Is it just that they happened to all be involved in that activity but had different goals and other ideological visions that they wanted to accomplish in Germany? But if you could, Kevin, finish where you left off, and then we will get to the root of that.
Just to enlarge on Scott's reference to the Pink Triangle, Willy Fritscher, in his historical documentation, identifies the brown shirts after the blood purge of July 1st, 1934, as he identifies the use of the brown triangle which was attached to Rome's followers, because after Rome's assassination or after he was eliminated in the purge, the brown shirts became enemies of the state. And one of the reasons for that is that some the brown shirts knew, the leadership, other leaders, rank and file knew that the SS had been complicit in the elimination of their leadership at a special meeting that was called, where Edmund Hines, Rome's gay lover, was assassinated and so forth, or was machine gunned by SS officers in the early morning. But they were labeled with brown triangles, which is a very few references to that. But that 150 SS officers were assassinated by Rome's followers in payback for the assassination of their leadership or the murder of their leadership. And the tunics to the tunics of the SS were attached Rome's Avengers, a note that this was in revenge for Rome's elimination. So they were made criminals, enemies of the state, and disbanded primarily, and they all had to be reapplied to enter into the newly constituted or expanded German Reichswehr or military, and so they were vetted anew for their character and proclivities and loyalties and so forth, and that was the end of the brown shirts at that point. But further to that, Carroll Quigley, in his monumental work Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, writes specifically on page, I think it's 436 of his book, or 434, that it was a homosexual, an arson squad comprised of homosexuals who were tasked with the torching of the Reichstag in 1934. And that was basically a way of engineering pretext for suspension of political opposition. And the Enabling Act was an outcome of the Reichstag fire the communists were blamed for, and so forth. What's really interesting is that Dinesh D'Souza has written a book which he titled The Big Lie, in which he exposes the Nazi movement as a left-wing socialist movement, which is something that that Scott and I have put forth for years now, and now Dinesh D'Souza has put the icing on the cake, so to speak, and really sort of brought forth the history of the North American democratic movement and their associations and affiliations and so forth in American history, which is quite revealing and irrefutable, and it's actually quite a revelation. It's probably on the same scale as the pink swastika is in terms of shaking people's belief system or what they've been convinced or seduced into believing.
Now, one thing that we, I think, have to point out, because it may have just flown right over the heads of many of our listeners, when you mentioned Ernst Röhm, many of our listeners probably never heard that name before, but Ernst Röhm was a very notorious, openly homosexual pederast. He was not ashamed of this behavior. He was not a closeted homosexual. He was well known by everyone as somebody who was a homosexual pederast, somebody who enjoyed the sexual company of teenage boys, or even younger. But he is also known by those who would consider themselves homosexual scholars and historians and liberal activists. They all know that Ernst Röhm was a practicing open homosexual. Nobody really denies Röhm's homosexuality, correct?
That's correct. It's irrefutable because he was so open about it, and actually quite an embarrassment to the party. Hitler was always having to cover for him. But, you've got to understand that Röhm was like a father figure to Hitler. Röhm is the one who discovered and made Hitler. And Hitler was very, very deeply indebted to Rome.
He was a Nazi really, before Hitler was, right? I mean, maybe not with that name, the National Socialist Party, but he was involved in that movement that Hitler joined, obviously before Hitler, correct?
Well, he was the power behind the throne in the early days.
Right.
Hitler addressed Rome with the personal prefix of Du, like it's an endearing prefix. It's basically my dear Führer, you know, and so forth. Only him and Rudolf Hess used that endearing term with Hitler. They were the only ones that were permitted to do that. So they were on a very personal basis with Hitler. But anyways, the history and the documentation of this correlation of homosexuality with the National Socialist and movement is quite substantial, and the Pink Swastika is supported by that documentation, which is bordering on over 200 different sources. So people, if they're willing to do an unbiased and open and objective study of the topic, and if they can get through the emotional blocks that they might have and the preconditioning that they've been subjected to on this particular topic, they'll come to a more clear, picture of what this particular history is and what it represents in terms of politics and geopolitical, problem, like in terms of what happened with Germany, in World War II and so forth, and how it became so ferociously, so militarized.
Now, I just want to also chime in just very quickly that one of the things that is fascinating about your book, The Pink Swastika, is how thoroughly documented it is, and much of the information that you and Scott have gathered comes from homosexual historians who were contemporaries of Hitler and who lived in that day, who were eyewitnesses of these things.
Exactly.
Let me comment to that point, because this is a... I think it's as many as 20% of our sources are homosexual, and frankly, there are a few, not very many, but there are a few college professors that have taken the stand that the Pink Swastika is illegitimate, and most of the historians of the Nazi period, they really don't know very much about the Nazi aspect. There are references throughout all of the works, thousands of references, but they're scattered, and they really don't jump out with the significance that they have until you overlay gay history over mainstream history. That's when you find the identification of all the individual figures as being homosexual. That many of the Nazi leaders in the early days and later were not known to be homosexual by the historians of the period. They were essentially outed by their own in the gay publications. And so only people who have both an understanding of the mainstream history and of gay history are going to be able to put the pieces together. And that's really the major thing that we did is to bring both parallel views and chronicles of what happened in the Nazi era, and weave them back together so that the whole picture could be shown.
Now, I want, as I mentioned earlier, I want you to give us an idea of what it was that the Nazi Party in its infancy was actually founded for, and what the ideology was, and was the homosexual aspect of it something that was quote coincidental, or was it actually a main thread in the theme of their ideology?
You want us to tackle that right now?
Yeah, because I think that it would be good to know why there even existed a Nazi party, and you've already said that the vast majority, if not all, of the initial members of this movement were actively involved in homosexual practice. Was that coincidental to the ideology? Was that coincidental to the core purpose that they gathered and tried to make an impact on Germany, which they unfortunately did, and upon the world? But if you could.
Well, there are two elements of the story that we need to bring in. We've mentioned the militarism and the nationalism that existed. That was, of course, a major theme. That the Weimar government that was established after World War I, it was socialist. It was aligned with the effeminate branch of the Nazi gay subculture, and it involved, you know, many more people than homosexuals were concerned about the socialists having taken over. That was one primary theme that was in play. The other was occultism, and the people that came together to form the Nazi Party really came out of an occultic background, this was particularly appealing, and always has been. Occultism has always been particularly appealing to homosexuals because they really don't have any place in the Judeo-Christian worldview, right? When they're looking for some spiritual, you know, legitimacy, they're going to the occult world because they're welcome there. So both of those sort of themes were in play when the Nazi Party was formed. And the people who formed the Nazi Party came out of occultism, but they took over an organization that was just simply a political party. It was the German Workers' Party. But they took it over in order to have a vehicle to be able to advance their nationalistic goals. And the homosexuality of the people was it was incidental to the purpose of the organization, but it was not accidental because the homosexuality bound them together. It established a sort of a special loyalty among the adherents. There's sort of a homosexual, homoerotic brotherhood in these butch-oriented, masculine-oriented homosexuals that was very different than any other group. And why they rose to prominence, why they pushed everyone out of the way, is that will to power was just sort of central to their sense of identity. That's, in fact, the whole concept of the will to power from Nietzsche is really a reflection of that butch masculine mentality.
And weren't there initial meetings held in a restaurant that was notorious for homosexual activity and pederasty?
Well, the National Socialist Movement met in a gay bar called the Bratwurst Glockel, and in Berlin, I believe it was.
And so that was like exclusively known.
That was actually in Munich, I think.
In Munich? Yeah.
It was in Munich, because that's actually in the early days. It was because there are a lot of things that were happening in Berlin too. But the reason I know that is because I visited the site. I actually, in a trip when I went to get my human rights credentials in Strasbourg during my law school days, we were right across the border in Strasbourg, and I took a weekend and went to Munich. And visited Dachau, and I also visited, and I was looking for the Bratwurst Glockel to see if I could find it if it still existed. And it was a building that had been demolished in the bombings and had been rebuilt, but I found the location, but it was no longer that facility, right behind the cathedral in Munich.
Okay,
it was a homosexual bar.
We're going to pick up right where you left off there, because we have to go to our midway break. Our midway break is longer than our normal breaks because Grace Life Radio 90.1 FM in Lake City, Florida requires a 12-minute break between our two segments. But please be patient with us. God willing, we'll be right back after these messages from our sponsors.
Hi, I'm Chris Arnson of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. Are you a Christian looking to align your faith and finances? Then you'll want to check out Thrivent Financial. They're not your typical financial services provider. They're a not-for-profit Fortune 500 organization that helps their nearly 2.4 million members to be wise with money. They provide guidance that reflects your values so you can protect what matters most.
They help members live generously and strengthen the communities where they live, work, and worship. Learn more about the Thrivent story by contacting Michael Gallagher at 717-254-6433. That's 717-254-6433.
We know we were made for so much more than ordinary life.
Blending faith, finances, and generosity. That's the Thrivent story.
Every day at thousands of community centers, high schools, middle schools, juvenile institutions, coffee shops, and local hangouts, Long Island Youth for Christ, staff and volunteers meet with young people who need Jesus. We are rural and urban, and we are always about the message of Jesus. Our mission is to have a noticeable spiritual impact on Long Island, New York, by engaging young people in the lifelong journey of following Christ. Long Island Youth for Christ has been a stalwart bedrock ministry since 1959. We have a world-class staff and a proven track record of bringing consistent love and encouragement to youths in need all over the country and around the world. Help honor our history by becoming a part of our future. Volunteer, donate, pray, or all of the above. For details, call Long Island Youth for Christ at 631-385-8333. That's 631-385-8333. Or visit liyfc.org. That's liyfc.org.
Iron Sharpens Iron welcomes Solid Rock Remodeling to our family of sponsors. Serving South Central Pennsylvania, Solid Rock Remodeling is focused on discovering, understanding, and exceeding your expectations. They deliver personalized project solutions with exceptional results. Solid Rock Remodeling offers a full range of home renovations, including kitchen and bath remodeling, decks, porches, windows and doors, roof and siding, and more. For a clear, detailed professional estimate, call this trustworthy team of problem solvers who provide superior results that stand the test of time. Call Solid Rock Remodeling at 717-697-1981, 717-697-1981, or visit solidrockremodeling.com. That's solidrockremodeling.com. Solid Rock Remodeling, bringing new life to your home.
Charles Haddon Spurgeon once said,
"Give yourself unto reading. The man who never reads will never be read. He who never quotes will never be quoted. He who will not use the thoughts of other men's brains proves that he has no brains of his own. You need to read."
Solid Ground Christian Books is a publisher and book distributor who takes these words of the Prince of Preachers to heart. The mission of Solid Ground Christian Books is to bring back treasures of the past to minister to Christians in the present and future, and to publish new titles that address burning issues in the church and the world. Since its beginning in 2001, Solid Ground has been committed to publish God-centered, Christ-exalting books for all ages. We invite you to go treasure hunting at solid-ground-books.com. That's solid-ground-books.com and see what priceless literary gems from the past or present you can unearth from Solid Ground. Solid Ground Christian Books is honored to be a weekly sponsor of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.
Chef Exclusive Catering is in South Central Pennsylvania. Chef Exclusive's goal is to provide a dining experience that is sure to please any palate. Chef Damian White of Chef Exclusive is a graduate of the renowned Johnson & Wales University with a degree in culinary arts and applied science. Chef Exclusive Catering's event center is newly designed with elegance and style and is available for small office gatherings, bridal showers, engagement parties, and rehearsal dinners. Critics and guests alike acknowledge Chef Exclusive's commitment to exceeding even the highest expectations.
I know of their quality firsthand since Chef Exclusive catered my most recent Iron Sharpens Iron Radio Pastor's Luncheon. For details, call 717-388-3000. That's 717-388-3000. Or visit chefexclusive.com. That's chefexclusive.com.
Paul wrote to the church at Galatia, "For am I now seeking the approval of man or of God? Nor am I trying to please man. If I were still trying to please man, I would not be a servant of Christ." Hi, I'm Mark Lukens, pastor of Providence Baptist Church. We are a Reformed Baptist church, and we hold to the London Baptist Confession of Faith of 1689. We are in Norfolk, Massachusetts. We strive to reflect Paul's mindset to be much more concerned with how God views what we say and what we do than how men view these things. That's not the best recipe for popularity, but since that wasn't the apostles' priority, it must not be ours either. We believe, by God's grace, that we are called to demonstrate love and compassion to our fellow man, and to be vessels of Christ's mercy to a lost and hurting community around us, and to build up the body of Christ in truth and love. If you live near Norfolk, Massachusetts, or plan to visit our area, please come and join us for worship and fellowship. You can call us at 508-528-5750. That's 508-528-5750. Or go to our website to email us, listen to past sermons, worship songs, or watch our TV program entitled Resting in Grace. You can find us at providencebaptistchurchma.org. That's providencebaptistchurchma.org. Or even on sermonaudio.com. Providence Baptist Church is delighted to sponsor Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.
Hi, I'm Pastor Bill Shishko, inviting you to tune in to A Visit to the Pastor's Study every Saturday from 12 noon to 1 p.m. Eastern Time on WLIE Radio, www.wlie540am.com. We bring biblically faithful pastoral ministry to you, and we invite you to visit the pastor's study by calling in with your questions. Our time will be lively, useful, and I assure you, never dull. Join us this Saturday at 12 noon Eastern Time for a visit to the pastor's study, because everyone needs a pastor.
Lynbrook Baptist Church on 225 Earl Avenue in Lynbrook, Long Island, is teaching God's timeless truths in the 21st century.
Our church is far more than a Sunday worship service.
It's a place of learning where the scriptures are studied and the preaching of the gospel is clear and relevant.
It's like a gym where one can exercise their faith through community involvement.
It's like a hospital for wounded souls where one can find compassionate people and healing.
We're a diverse family of all ages,
enthusiastically serving our Lord Jesus Christ
in fellowship, play, and together.
Hi, I'm Pastor Bob Waldeman, and I invite you to come and join us here at Lynbrook Baptist Church and see all that a church can be.
Call Lynbrook Baptist at 516-599-9402. That's 516-599-9402. Or visit lynbrookbaptist.org. That's lynbrookbaptist.org.
Hi, I'm Buzz Taylor, frequent co-host with Chris Arnson on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. I would like to introduce you to my good friends Todd and Patty Jennings at CVBBS, which stands for Cumberland Valley Bible Book Service. Todd and Patty specialize in supplying Reformed and Puritan books and Bibles at discount prices that make them affordable to everyone. Since 1987, the family-owned and operated book service has sought to bring you the best available Christian books and Bibles at the best possible prices. Unlike other book sites, they make no effort to provide every book that is available because, frankly, much of what is being printed is not worth your time. That means you can get to the good stuff faster. It also means that you don't have to worry about being assaulted by the pornographic, heretical, and otherwise faith-insulting material promoted by the secular book vendors. Their website is cvbbs.com. Browse the pages at ease, shop at your leisure, and purchase with confidence as Todd and Patty work in service to you, the church, and to Christ. That's Cumberland Valley Bible Book Service at cvbbs.com. That's cvbbs.com. Let Todd and Patty know that you heard about them on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.
And you can also call cvbbs.com at their toll-free number, 800-656-0231, 800-656-0231. And if you order $50 or more of merchandise, you are getting a free book, Theology of the Reformers by Dr. Timothy George, which retails for $29.99. You'll get that absolutely free with a $50 minimum purchase. And on top of all that, they are offering 10% off everything in their stock, in their inventory, even things that are already discounted. You get an additional 10% off of everything. So go to cvbbs.com or call 800-656-0231. And I also need to announce a couple of special events that are coming up that our listeners need to be aware of before we return to our discussion with Scott Lively and Kevin Abrams on their book, The Pink Swastika, Homosexuality in the Nazi Party. This Friday, December 8th, from 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m., CBMC, which stands for Christian Businessmen's Connection, is having a special Christmas event. Everyone is welcome to attend, and it's on the theme, Joseph, the Quiet Hero of Christmas. The keynote speaker at this event is my dear friend Marcus A. McKnight III, attorney at law, managing shareholder at Irwin & McKnight PC. And if you would like to register for this event, you can call 717-249-2353. That's 717-249-2353. It's being held at the Comfort Suites of downtown Carlisle, Pennsylvania, on 10 South Hanover Street. And if you mention that you heard about this event from Chris Arnzen on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio, they are going to waive your $20 registration and you'll get in absolutely free of charge. So once again, the phone number to call is 717-249-2353, 717-249-2353. That's this Friday, December 8th, from 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m., the CBMC Special Christmas Event, Joseph, the Quiet Hero of Christmas, featuring keynote speaker Marcus A. McKnight III, attorney at law, who's also a former elder at the church where I am currently a member, Grace Baptist Church of Carlisle, and he is currently a member of the West Shore Evangelical Free Church in Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania. Then coming up in January from the 17th through the 20th, the G3 conference returns to Atlanta, Georgia. The G3 stands for Grace, Gospel, and Glory. The theme of this January's conference is Knowing God, a Biblical Understanding of Discipleship. Starting on the 17th, during the daytime, there will be an exclusively Spanish-speaking edition of the conference. Then, on the evening of January 17th, there is a debate between my dear friend Dr. James R. White of Alpha and Omega Ministries and a Muslim apologist. Then the conference itself picks up on the 18th through the 20th. This is exclusively in the English language. And the featured speakers this time around at the G3 conference include, in addition to Dr. James R. White, Stephen Lawson, Vody Balcom, Phil Johnson, Keith Getty, H.B. Charles Jr., Tim Challies, Josh Bice, Tom Askell, Anthony Mathenia, Michael Kruger, David Miller, Paul Tripp, Todd Friel, Derek Thomas, Martha Peace, and Justin Peters. If you'd like to register for that G3 conference, go to g3conference.com. G3conference.com. Please make sure you tell them that you heard about the event from Chris Arnzen on Iron Sharpens and Iron Radio. Last but not least, I have to beg you for money. The advertisers that have spent hard-earned money keeping this program on the air have compelled me, have urged me for quite a long time to make public appeals for donations, and for years I resisted. But several months ago, I caved in because of the fact that we are in such hard financial straits. It is a very serious situation where we may go off the air, and I'm not exaggerating that. If you really love this program, you don't want it to go away, go to ironsharpensironradio.com, click on support, and you will be given a mailing address where you can mail a check made payable to Iron Sharpens Iron Radio for any amount that you can afford. Please never, ever, ever siphon money out of your regular giving to the church where you are a member, and never, ever take food off of your family's dinner table if you're struggling to make ends meet. Only donate to us if you are able to financially, if you are blessed far above and beyond your ability to obey those two commands of God, providing for church and home. But if you are blessed in that manner, please consider donating to Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. Go to ironsharpensironradio.com, click on support, and you'll have that address where you can mail a check. And I thank all of you who have been doing that, and some of you have been doing it every single month. I cannot even describe in the English language how grateful to God I am for you. And if you want to advertise with us, just send me an email to chrisarnzen@gmail.com and put advertising in the subject line, And as long as whatever it is you're advertising is compatible with the theology expressed on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio, we would love to help you launch an ad campaign. That's also the email address where you could send a question for our guests, Scott Lively and Kevin Abrams, on the theme, the pink swastika, homosexuality in the Nazi Party, and we are discussing its relevance in the 21st century, especially in America. That's chrisarnson@gmail.com. Please give us your first name, city and state, and country of residence if you live outside of the USA. And Scott, you were saying before the break that you had visited Munich to find some landmarks, especially the homosexual tavern where the Nazi Party began. It must have been an interesting question for the tour guide. Can you bring me to the Nazi Party homosexual bar? But tell us if
I do my own touring. So,
Well, if you could pick up where you left off there, if you had anything, because I do want to eventually soon get to some of our listener questions.
Well, I was able to find the location. I don't think the building was completely destroyed, but it was. It was not the same facility, and I really wasn't expecting after all those years it would be, but I thought maybe. I did have a chance to go and have a meal at the Hofbrauhaus, which is one of the places that was famous for Hitler's patronage, and then I found in the subway system, of Munich, there's a whole extensive, underground, level of the city in the center, just filled with the kind of perversion that it existed in the Weimar period. Germany was notorious for really being like San Francisco on steroids.
Yeah, that's what the cabaret play was all about. That correct?
Yes, yes. Well, you know, it was the direct consequence of the rise of occultism and the rejection of Christianity. That was remember that Germany had been the place where the higher criticism movement had arisen,
right?
That denied the authority of the Torah and the New Testament, and in the place of that authority, occultism came flooding in, and with it every kind of perversion, both sexual and otherwise.
All right, we do have a listener from San Jose, California, Daniel, who says, can you ask how open was homosexuality amongst the Nazis, and was it looked down upon? Also, can you ask how did homosexuality influence the Nazi society as a whole and its influence here in the United States? Well, that's actually three questions there. How open? I mean, we already discussed.
The first one there, Kevin?
The Nazi movement was quite well known to be fairly mixed up with homosexuality. The first book burning in Berlin in 1930. Which year was that, Scott?
33.
The 33 book burning. The first book burning was to destroy 40,000 files that Magnus Hirschfeld held in his institute on sexual crimes or convicted sexual criminals in Germany under Section 175 of the German Penal Code, who were sent to Magnus Hirschfeld's Institute for examination and treatment and whatever else went on there.
This was a cover-up.
It was kind of a cover-up. So basically the book burning was to get rid of evidence. It was actually an evidence-destroying event.
Evidence that Nazis were homosexuals.
That's right, yeah.
Before we move on, after Kevin finishes his point, I want to add something.
Okay. It was fairly well known because Rome was so open about it, and they knew that you couldn't really rise up in the National Socialist movement, in the Brown Shirt movement, unless you were homosexual. But you were excluded. I mean, you may have had some lower ranking people who were maybe less inclined in that manner, but the upper leadership was probably to a man. I haven't found very many who, in the upper leadership of the brown shirts, who weren't homosexual, who we would consider to be gay. And like we say, like we explain, they didn't very much like the effeminate homosexuals. So for political purposes or for purposes of identification, we would make a distinction between, say, homosexuals and militant gays.
Now, one thing I have to ask about that, and I don't want you to get graphic or anything, but one thing that I find bizarre is that if they looked down upon and hated effeminate homosexuals so much, who were their partners? I mean, were they both butch? I mean, were they?
No. The militant gay likes young boys, and the effeminate homosexual, really goes after actually heterosexual men.
So the young boys that were the victims of these Nazi pederasts, homosexual pederasts, they were not viewed as effeminate themselves, these young boys?
No.
It's like the Islamic phenomenon that
especially in Afghanistan,
away from women, right? And that they do not look at prepubescent males in the same way. I mean, they're a sexual target, and it's considered acceptable. And that's, of course, the stories out of Afghanistan confirm that. But I want to make one point back to the last about the book burning, and that I just acquired a copy of a fairly recent book titled Gay Berlin. I think you recommended it, Kevin. I picked up a copy of it, and I was just flipping through it, and right there in the center of the book is a picture of the book burning with a caption that admits what we're talking about.
And wow.
They may have read the big swastika and just simply adopted it for themselves, because they used to deny this, but now they're admitting it.
So this is not something. This is not coming from people who are sympathetic to your views against homosexuality.
Oh no, not by any means. Oh, and you know, one other thing: if you're at your computer right now, if you're listening, go to your computer and just type in the strange story of the gay fascist. It's the title of an article by Johan Hari that's published on the Huffington Post. Right, this is a gay journalist on the Huffington Post admitting the rampant homosexuality among the neo-Nazis of the modern era and homosexuality among the Nazis. And then, of course, it ends, the last paragraph bashes the pink swastika, without a basis after having laid the groundwork for confirming it.
Well, that's weird. Why would he do that? Why would he bash the pink swastika if he was affirming the thesis of your book?
Because he's saying it's an anomaly. This is just an anomaly, and Lively and Abrams are crazy because they're saying it's not an anomaly. That's really the essence of it. But it's just a damage control, because he knows that these admissions that he's making are really going to put him at odds with a lot of people on the left. So the way he covers for it is he bashes us and says, whenever he gets complaints, he just points to that paragraph.
And Kevin, I don't know if you finished your strain or your stream of thought. Your
stream of thinking.
Yeah, right. If you haven't, okay, go ahead.
I just wanted to mention that, just to follow up on what Scott was reporting on the German Workers' Party, when the Nazis took over the German Workers' Party, they renamed it, and they prefaced it with the National Socialist German Workers' Party. So the Nazis were socialists. They were left-wing. They used some of the industrialists. The industrialists served their military and political agendas, but the conservatives were eliminated from the German military, like von Fritsch and von Blomberg, who were head of the German military at that time, were not really in favor of Hitler's military and political agenda, and so they were framed. Actually, one of them, von Fritsch, on false charges of homosexuality, trumped up charges of homosexuality to have him removed from his position in a scandal, for which he was later exonerated and then sent to the Russian front, where he perished in World War II. But von Fritsch was one of the ones that that demanded that Hitler do something about Rome in 1934. That they were going to turn against Hitler if he didn't do something about Rome, because Rome was becoming a liability to them as far as the industrialists and
Now, was it mainly because of Rome's power struggle, or was it because of his homosexuality?
Both. Because Rome wanted to use the German, the regular officer class that was left over from World War One in the German army, as a training, kind of a training contingent for the brown shirts, and make them subject to the rule, to his rule. And so the German, the aristocratic officer class wanted to have nothing to do with that, and they demanded that Hitler do. They were either going, it was either Hitler or Rome, and so Rome had to turn against. Or Hitler had to turn against Rome in 1934 to consolidate his power, for which Hindenburg congratulated him. He wrote a letter of congratulation. Hitler acted in the hour of Germany's greatest need, and so forth. So that's
well, one of the things.
Let me tag team on that.
Sure.
Point out that 1934. Remember, Hitler came to power at the end of 32, and I mean there was the election. 33 was the transitional year. And that nobody expected the Nazis were gonna take power, until they did, and they only did it by framing the communists for the burning of the Reichstag. But once they were in power, then all that they had been planning all these years, you know, from the very beginning, Hitler would run the government and Ernst Röhm would run the military, right? And so the fact that this was now coming to fruition. Now you've got the entire conservative military-industrial complex now is freaking out because Ernst Röhm, this notorious pederast from Munich, right? From the orgies in the Brown House now, or the Brown Fairies are now going to take over the military, and so they're scrambling for what to do, and they force Hitler to get rid of Ernst Röhm.
That was the night of the Long Knives, correct?
Right, that's the night of the Long Knives, and at the same time, Hitler now knows that he can no longer. He had been suppressing rumors about his own homosexuality for a long time, kind of deflecting it off on these radicals at the head of the brown shirts. But everyone around him in his inner circle almost was a homosexual, and but in order to be able to rule now, instead of just be a party. He had to change his whole public relations strategy, and he had to now come out harshly against homosexuality in the public in order to discourage the rumors about himself. So one of the things he did on the night of the Long Knives is he slaughtered every person who had known him when he was a male prostitute on the streets of Munich and Vienna.
That's a documentable thing on the police record that still exists today, doesn't it? That he was arrested for prostitution.
Yes. It was documented. We get secondhand sources. I think the original documents were burned at the same time that he was slaughtering all the people that knew it. All the people with the firsthand knowledge about Hitler's perversions were all killed. There was as many as 2,000 people killed on the night of the Long Knives.
Actually, in addition to that, the officers who were involved in the torching of the Reichstag on June 30th, July 1st. 1934 were eliminated in the or 30 yeah 34 they were eliminated or no actually the torching of the Reichstag in 33 were eliminated in the Bludge Purge of 34 because they didn't want any wagging tongues. They didn't want anybody talking about who torched the Reichstag. They wanted to let it lie as a communist act and cover that all up. So the Nazis were very good at covering things up, and didn't want to get out.
So when we hear constantly the drumbeat from the liberal media about homosexuals being persecuted by the Nazis with the same fervency as they persecuted the Jews at times, it is alleged, or it is insinuated at least, this is just because of a cover-up that was going on, and it was anywhere remotely close to the kind of persecutions that Jews and Gypsies and others received.
Exactly, but the effeminate homosexuals were many of them a small number, relatively speaking. James Stickley identifies the numbers in his book on the Holocaust and persecution of the Jews and so forth. But he was a homosexual historian too, and he identifies some 5,000 or 6,000 homosexuals that were some of them were sex tortured to death, and the Nazis were fairly cruel with the effeminate side of the homosexual world. It's kind of a riddle, you know. To disentangle all this stuff is really quite a riddle. It's kind of like it takes a forensic investigation to sort of put things where they belong. Like so that you don't confuse one side with the other, and you have to study the chronology. And like Scott was just pointing out, there was a change in Hitler's strategy and the way that he wanted to publicly portray himself to the German public and so forth. And Hindenburg, of course, congratulated him, like I mentioned. And so it was like it was a transitional process up to the point when Hitler achieved absolute power. And one of the means by which he did that, of course, was the burning of the Reichstag in 1933, which was an engineering, a pretext for social and political action, right? Social, political, and military action. So that's called, I call that the Reichstag pretext. You know, we've seen many of these types of instances.
False flag.
It was like the classic false flag was the Reichstag, the torching of the Reichstag in 19. And Carol Quigley goes into detail, and anybody that wants to have an accounting of what really went on
in Germany, in Tragedy and Hope,
it's an excellent account of what really occurred. So, but there's been an extreme and a monumental effort to cover up and pervert and invert, and actually, Dinesh D'Souza does an excellent job of describing that inversion of roles and who's a Nazi and so forth, and who has the, because to be a Nazi is a psychological profile. It has nothing to do with race whatsoever. It's a psychological profile, and it has to do with character and morality, and there's a spirit about it too.
It's a homoerotic ideology.
Yeah, it's a militaristic ideology, and all through history, like whether it's the Zambia of Papua New Guinea or the Spartans, or whether there's a strong homoerotic bond that binds these people together, and it's like a homoerotic brotherhood. And juxtaposed with the homoerotic brotherhood throughout history has been the fraternal brotherhood that protects the family and the community and so forth. So it's more of a fraternal, more of a nurturing kind of brotherhood that is strongly male and masculine, but in a benevolent and fraternal way. And it's far, far different than the homoerotic, which is you're trying to develop the ultimate warrior or the Ubermensch kind of character and this type of thing.
One thing that I want to ask you, Kevin, before we run out of time later and I forget to ask, because I think this is a very vital aspect of our discussion. I think one of the reasons that this is very important, this discussion, one of the many reasons, is that the victimhood of the Jews and the Gypsies and others during the Holocaust, where millions of them were tortured and exterminated, the victimhood of the Jews is being diluted by homosexual activists who are jumping on that bandwagon of demanding to be viewed as a persecuted people, if you will.
Right.
And I want to know from you as an Orthodox Jew how this offends you, because I think this is one of the main reasons we should talk about things like this.
Well, the Holocaust is one of the most powerful and dramatic victim metaphors available for social or political purposes in the last century. And so it's exploited not only by, the homosexual movement, but by other groups too. It's like a Holocaust. They use the term Holocaust to refer to, if there's a Holocaust of this or that or the other thing. But it's a victim metaphor, and of course the victim is designed, if you can identify as a victim, and there's this victim mentality, the sense of entitlement and victimhood and which the process goes like this: I'm a victim, so I get to be vindictive, and I don't have to really do anything about why I'm doing what I'm doing. I just, I demand, I'm entitled to compensation, I'm entitled. So victim politics is kind of rampant in American culture, in North America, in the Western world today. And that's really caused a lot of schisms in our culture and our society. But the exploitation of the Holocaust was a very cynical move, because the idea is to solicit the sanction and the compassion of a people who are predisposed to have sympathy for the victim, and so it's a very kind of predatory type of practice and mentality to exploit the victimhood. And many of these people that exploit this victim metaphor had nothing to do with the Holocaust. I mean, they weren't victims of the Holocaust. They're not victims themselves, but they exploit the Holocaust for political currency. And so the Holocaust is being unjustly exploited for political currency and to gain political and social concessions. And that, it's a tremendous insult to those who were actually victimized by, and really true victims, people who suffer victimhood in life. Usually they just move on and get on with their life and sort of learn from what happened, and often they're too embarrassed to admit they were victims. But the false victim always, you know, announces and parades around about his victimhood and makes a big deal out of it. So I think victim politics are some of the most, that's one of the most destructive influences in American society today, and I see that as a real downside of how the Holocaust has been exploited.
Now, wasn't there a backlash or an outcry from people who, Jews, were actually victims of the Holocaust when they had heard that one of the Holocaust museums included a wing dedicated to homosexual victims, and they were upset because they knew that the homosexuals were actually torturing them and making life even more miserable in the camps for them. Isn't that something that occurred?
Well, this is the double-edged sword. I mean, on one hand, there's the victim, and often what happens to the victim is they move on to become a victimizer, or they seek healing for their victimization when they were younger. Like Milo, he understands that he was victimized, sexually molested, and so he's gone on to try and, you know, make sense of his life. And
that's the person that we see in the media who's a very effeminate libertarian. Yes. He calls himself a libertarian.
Yes.
Right. Okay.
Yes. 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 But you know, one thing about Milo, he's pretty honest guy, and he he has this. He's more from the effeminate side of the homosexual world, and he has been sexual. And a lot of this happens when people are younger. This is how a lot of people are inducted into the homosexual world.
Yeah, this is the other side of pederasty.
Yeah.
These are pederasts. Will frequently grow up to be pederasts themselves.
That's right. So the victim becomes the victimizer that way, and they just think that it's just part of the, you know, part.
Wasn't there a protest though by Jewish victims of the Holocaust survivors at one point? I don't know if it was in Israel or somewhere.
You might be thinking of there was a. I remember that there was a gay pride parade, one of the early gay pride parades in Israel, where there was a man who was standing on the side of the parade screaming, "My family was killed, you know, by you people."
There's no doubt that if it hadn't have been for the militant gays in Germany, that the Nazi Party probably never would have occurred. It just wouldn't have happened.
All right, we're going to our final break right now. If anybody wants to join us on the air, do so quickly at chrisarnson@gmail.com. We have a few of you still waiting to get on with your questions, and we'll get to as many of you as possible as long as time permits, or as many as time permits. Don't go away. God willing, we'll be right back with Scott Lively and Kevin Abrams on the pink swastika.
Tired of box store Christianity, of doing church in a warehouse with all the trappings of a rock concert? Do you long for a more traditional and reverent style of worship? And how about the preaching? Perhaps you've begun to think that in-depth biblical exposition has vanished from Long Island. Well, there's good news. Wading River Baptist Church exists to provide believers with a meaningful and reverent worship experience, featuring the systematic exposition of God's Word. And this loving congregation looks forward to meeting you. Call them at 631-929-3512 for service times. 631-929-3512. Or check out their website at wrbc.us. That's wrbc.us.
I'm James White of Alpha and Omega Ministries. The New American Standard Bible is perfect for daily reading or in-depth study. Used by pastors, scholars, and everyday readers, the NASB is widely embraced and trusted as a literal and readable Bible translation. The NASB offers clarity and readability while maintaining high accuracy to the original languages, which the NASB is known for. The NASB is available in many editions like a topical reference Bible. Researched and prepared by biblical scholars devoted to accuracy, the new topical reference Bible includes contemporary topics relevant to today's issues. From compact to giant print Bibles, find an NASB that fits your needs very affordably at nasbible.com. Whichever edition you choose, trust, discover, and enjoy the NASB for yourself today. Go to nasbible.com. That's nasbible.com.
Welcome back. This is Chris Sarnes, and this is our final 25 minutes or so of our interview with Scott Lively and Kevin Abrams on their book, The Pink Swastika, Homosexuality in the Nazi Party, now entering into its fifth edition due to a lot of new discoveries and documentable evidence to prove the point of their thesis. And if you'd like to join us, now's the time to do it, chrisarnson@gmail.com. And one of the things that we didn't get to that Daniel in San Jose, California brings up is he says first of all, when the Nazi Party became this massive machine, when there were thousands and thousands of people involved in this party, and they were on the brink of conquering the world, how heavily influenced was this party at that point by actual people practicing homosexuality, and how well known was it among the party itself when it became this massive thing?
Well, let me jump in on this one, because this is the greater the number of people in the Nazi Party and in the brown shirts, of course, the more the homosexuality was diluted, and it was but it was always in the upper echelons anyways, in the leadership. But what's really most important to remember is that that really doesn't matter much at this point in history, because this was a movement put on a trajectory because of its initial ideology. This was the ideology of the butch homosexuals who believed that every nation state in the history of the world had been created by their own kind, and that that super macho hierarchical militaristic, you know, very aggressive macho male culture that continued to define Nazism and then the whole nation all the way through. So it really didn't matter in the later days what percentage of the leaders were homosexual at that point, because it was a machine that had, it was a robot, a juggernaut that had already been built and was steamrolling over the cultures of the world.
And the other thing that Daniel asks about is the influence of homosexual Nazism here in America. I happen to know that while reading the book, the classic work on George Lincoln Rockwell called Hate, George Lincoln Rockwell and the American Nazi Party, that Rockwell was continually embarrassed by homosexual activity going on amongst his small band of nut jobs. And in fact,
so he said.
Yeah. Well, and you go on YouTube and you see him being interviewed, and the interviewer is addressing that very thing about the rumors, the rampant rumors that the American Nazi Party was a band of homosexuals. And then we have Frank Collins, who picked up the mantle after the assassination of George Lincoln Rockwell years later, when Frank Collins began the National Socialist Party here in America, or relaunched it. He was arrested for homosexual pederasty, right?
Yeah, well, he's notorious for 1977 leading the Nazi march on Skokie,
right?
Which actually wasn't in Skokie at that point. They sort of put him in a box so that the only thing he could actually do was sort of get a bunch of his guys in the back of a truck and drove through Chicago.
And they picked Skokie because of the high population of Holocaust survivors, correct?
Right, right. And this guy, he was the classic homosexual Nazi. And then a couple years after this incident, he's arrested for having sex with teenage boys, went to prison, and then he got out. In fact, Kevin sent me a sort of an update on profile, and he'd gone into what did he go into, Kevin? A cult or something?
I went into authoring books about Atlantis and so forth.
Yeah,
he changed his name.
And he was not open though about his homosexuality, I don't think. Correct?
No, it wasn't until he was arrested for pederasty that it came out.
And you guys,
another figure.
Go ahead.
The The other figure in American history that is very important, seldom mentioned, is Henry Gerber. Henry Gerber was an American Army serviceman that served in Germany, post-World War I Germany, as part of the occupation forces in Germany. And he sought out and joined the Bund für Menschenrechte, which was the Nazi arm of the homosexual movement in Germany, and brought back that movement to Chicago in 1925-26, and set up the first chapter of the Bund für Menschenrechte in America. So that was the original seed of the Nazi movement insofar as the psychosexual roots of Nazi fascism is concerned.
Yeah, and in fact, the guy that was the leader of the... Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, I just wanted to... you're missing when you're... If you don't know German, you don't know the significance of the title. This is the German Society for Human Rights, right? So just think about that for a second.
Right.
The whole concept of homosexuality as a human right begins with the Nazis.
Right, and one of the things that I learned from your book, The Pink Swastika, is that the leader, or one of the leaders of the ACT UP movement that used to vandalize churches and do all kinds of grotesque things during worship services, perhaps predominantly in Roman Catholic churches, that person later admit that he was influenced heavily by Mein Kampf, correct?
Well, yes, of course, and the killers of Columbine, I believe, same thing. And also they had been. I remember reading one of the first stories that came out about Klebold and the other guy was that they had been reading Thus Spoke Zarathustra, which was Nietzsche's book. And we haven't talked much about Nietzsche, but even though Nietzsche himself was anti-fascist personally, he created the philosophy that empowered them. And then, of course, his sister Elizabeth, after Nietzsche died from syphilis that he acquired at a homosexual brothel in Italy, Elizabeth is the one who melded Nietzschean fascism with Nazism, and really provided the philosophical, the pillars of philosophical genius that everyone, at least what everyone thought was genius, was really insanity. That the Nazis became famous for.
In fact, you guys wrote about in your book, I don't remember the person's name, it wasn't in America, it was in England, in the UK, that the, I believe the founder or one of the founders of the skinhead movement, who was a brutal, violent individual, actually died of AIDS, and he was a homosexual involved in homosexual pornography, am I right? He was in the
National Front. I forget the guy's name myself. It was the National Front, which still exists today. But the same thing. Even though we're somewhat more sympathetic to the French party that's risen up, Marine. Oh, I forget her name. Le Pen. When Le Pen took over for her father and was rising up, she's sort of getting a pass from the conservatives in the U.S., but her second in command is a homosexual. And that, sort of militaristic nationalism just attracts male homosexuals like moths to a flame. And so they're salted all through the organizations and often are the leaders themselves and really come to define the sort of identity that everyone's pursuing. What are the National Front people doing, going around in their big boots and acting like bullies on the street? It's straight out of the early brown shirt days. Same mentality.
And by the way, thank you, Daniel. Daniel from San Jose, California, for your question. In fact, you have won because of your contribution to our show today. You have won a copy of the fourth edition of the Pink Swastika. And we thank you for being a part of our program today. Keep spreading the word about Iron Sharp and Zion Radio in San Jose, California, and beyond. We have a listener in Slovenia, Joe in Slovenia, who says, "Dear Brother Chris, this topic is so unsettling, yet I'm again thankful to you for having the courage to address the tough topics. I've always been puzzled by the fact that Adolf Hitler never married until just hours before his death, and is not known to have had heterosexual relations with women. It seems really strange to me that Eva Braun was his companion, who apparently was frustrated by the arrangement since she tried to commit suicide twice. Was she just a fixture to create the illusion that Hitler was heterosexual? Did Hitler not marry and conduct a normal heterosexual life with her because he was, in fact, a sodomite? And it's interesting that in the original editions of the Pink Swastika, you guys both did not believe, or at least you didn't have documented evidence, that Hitler was himself a homosexual, but you later became convinced of it. If you could explain that.
Well, we did make reference to Hitler's homosexuality in Vienna during the early days, that he's registered in the Viennese police records as being a homosexual prostitute. So I don't think that we, and basically if the people that you surround yourself with are any measure of your own character, then certainly he surrounded himself with well-known homosexuals during both the Weimar and the period of his rise to power after Weimar. So I think we've mentioned it, but there was never, there was never, you know, documented evidence to any great extent, because this, as Scott has pointed out, this is something that Hitler wanted to conceal and cover up. There has been other books written, like The Hidden Hitler by Mauthen, I believe it is.
Yeah, Lothar Mauthen.
Yes, and he wrote a book, and where he brings forth the thesis that Hitler did have homosexual or homoerotic proclivities. But I don't think that there's any doubt. It doesn't, you know, he had relations with a half a dozen or so women. Three of them did commit suicide, I understand. And
one of them was his niece, right?
Yeah, his niece was Gelly, yeah. Actually, she may have been, you know, because she was being loose-lipped about Hitler's proclivities, I think she was probably, something was taken.
She was exposing the fact that he was a corpophile,
yeah.
Correct?
Yes,
well,
that's right.
Uncle
Adolf had strange habits otherwise, and that wasn't really acceptable to people like Goring.
She was brought into line, though, and then she was later married off to Baldur von Schirach, the head of the Hitler Youth, when he needed cover. See, what Eva Braun was and what Gelly was a beard. It's called a beard, it's essentially a woman who will agree to marry a man, a homosexual, in order to give him political cover. And frankly, there are allegations about lots of people in that situation. Presently, I'm not going to get myself sued by identifying the political figure that I've heard. I heard a personal story, it was a secondhand story, actually, that one of the governors of another state, I won't mention, that he approached a woman and asked her to marry him for that purpose, and she turned him down, and a close friend of hers is the person who told me that. And I believe it just from this particular individual. But that's what Eva Braun was, that's what Gelly was, and it's not all that uncommon.
And I want to make sure that we get this in before we go off the air, because we're running out of time. But without just speculation, without just having a guttural feeling about it, who can you confirm in Nazi leadership from documented evidence was a homosexual?
Well, there's quite a few. I mean, Lothar Mauthen's book is quite powerful. Lothar Mauthen is a German history professor at Bremen University, or in Bremen, and he doesn't go into any of the things that we do with the Pink Swastika. It's really exclusively to the question, was Adolf Hitler a homosexual? But in doing that analysis, he's citing many primary sources, and he names all the partners. So he listed, for example, I can see the guy's face in my head. I can't remember his name right now.
The guy that was assassinated. Was it?
No. This is a more obscure one. Well, he was a very high-ranking Nazi leader. But I'll list off some of them here. Julius Streicher, who's not known to Americans very well, but he was Hitler's very close friend. He was a pornographer and an ally. one of the few people, Hitler, you actually have a picture of Hitler actually standing in a crowd listening to his speech by this guy. You know, this is how much he sort of revered this, his buddy. Kevin mentioned Edmund Hines, Wolf von Helldorf, and then the people directly around Hitler, William Funk, his financial advisor, who became the Reich Minister of Economics, was a homosexual. Hans Frank, Hitler's lawyer, became the Gauleiter of one of the big districts, was a homosexual. Goering was a transvestite. Rudolf Hess was a homosexual. Maurice, was Hitler's chauffeur. Emil Maurice was his last name, Maurice. Emil Maurice was a homosexual. The list just goes on and on and on. And the more time that we've spent, and we've continued our research, we continue to find more evidence and more people. You wouldn't think that after 400 pages of documentation on a fairly obscure topic that there would be anything left. But
yes, in fact, there was a secular documentary on the Nuremberg trials, and this was a secular documentary, and it affirmed that Hermann Goering, when he was arrested by the American military, he had on his possession women's makeup. They actually brought that up. They made a point of bringing that up in the documentary. Well, tell us about these new discoveries that are not included in the fourth edition of the Pink Swastika, or some of them anyway.
Well, it's hard to do that. The style of doing the book is to weave new source material into the existing text. So it basically is just, it's expanding. And for example, the fifth edition we're publishing as a series of short books based on the original chapters that were in the fourth edition, so it's material that just simply highlights or bolsters or extends a particular point, identifies a particular person, and I couldn't rattle off a list like I did the fourth edition material. It is not on the tip of my tongue like that is after having done 1,000 speeches on the topic. But you take my word, we have a 3-foot stack of additional material, and most of it we still haven't gotten to the point of including. This type of writing and research-based writing is very time intensive, and it's the reason why it's taken so long to do the fifth edition.
Well, I'd like you.
I think Scott would agree. It's been a very tough topic too. It's not an easy easy topic to navigate or to contend with. I mean, it is a controversial topic, and really we were sort of going against the flow and the environmental expectations, the popular opinion on the topics, and so forth. So it was quite an endeavor to put this book together in the first place. From an emotional and intellectual perspective, it's quite a you really have to sort of temper yourself to the material that you're dealing with.
Well, I'd like you each to make sure that you let our listeners know, why is this relevant in the 21st century, especially in America? And because this, other than the fact that this is maybe fascinating for those who love war history and all that kind of thing, they might find this oddity of history to be fascinating. But other than that, what practical input does this have to our current generation here in the 20s?
This is not an oddity of history. That's the point. There's nothing new under the sun. And that what happened in Germany is just a chapter of a very long book that spans millennia.
I guess what I meant by that was odd behavior by global movement that nearly conquered the world. That's really what I meant.
Well, history is prologue. History is prologue. You know, if you can't learn from history, I mean, if you have good information, you have an accurate account of history and so forth, then there are lessons that can be derived therefrom. But if history is being distorted and misrepresented, then the lessons that you'll come away with will only make the problem worse or make the situation worse. So we're trying to pick up some true lessons from history. Those who fail to learn from history are doomed to repeat the same mistakes of the past. And so we're trying to get one up on previous mistakes, so to speak.
Yeah, protect the next generation by educating. Yeah, yeah, and one other point to that is that as a Christian, and I think most of the listeners are Christians, one of the things I like to point out in my talks on this is that the pink swastika is really documentary evidence in support of Romans chapter 1. What the Apostle Paul describes as the culture of the day in Romans, which I believe he wrote in Corinth, which was a debauched city, it points out this is a timeless phenomenon. And that you can look all the way ahead to Germany in the 20th century, and you can see the exact same culture that exists then, that existed in Corinth at the time that Paul wrote that letter to the Romans. And so all through history, there's this poison stream. That's a term coined by one of our primary sources, a German Jew named Samuel Igra, who wrote Germany's National Vice, and that which would have been world famous if he hadn't published it so late. It was only published just shortly after the end of World War II, when everybody was wanting to breathe a big sigh of relief and then move on. His book comes out documenting so much of what, you know, we borrowed so much from his work, that what he coined the phrase, a poison stream. And then he cites different incidents over the course of history that are just like ripples on the pond, of which the Nazi period is just one ripple.
Chris, there's a quote on the back of our book by Samuel Igra, I think, that will respond to one of your earlier questions. And Samuel Igra writes, "For the purposes of the present investigations, Hitler is important for what he has represented when he embarked the German people on the policy that brought about the world catastrophe. He was the central figure around which a number of men grouped themselves from the 1920s onwards, in a movement to gain supreme control of the German people. As the movement developed, they were aided and abetted and supported financially as well as politically by the industrial capitalists of the Rhineland. But the initiative did not come from the latter. It came from Hitler as the contadori of a band of evil men who were united together by a common vice."
Wow.
And, of course, homosexuality is that common vice.
Well, I'd like you to now, in 2 minutes, summarize what you most want etched in the hearts and minds of our listeners today involving this this program, and you could each chime in if you'd like, and I'll let you know when we're running out of time.
Okay, you go first, Scott.
Well, I just would repeat that there's nothing new under the sun, that what happened in Germany was not an anomaly, that the phenomenon of homosexuality, if you look at what's happened in the United States over the course of these several decades, it can only be described as gay supremacy, right? That Judeo-Christian ideology and morality has been crushed under the jackboots of a fascist movement that has attained almost exclusive cultural authority, and that people who continue to hold a Judeo-Christian worldview are being pushed aside and punished just for believing that homosexuality is morally wrong, like this man who's at the Supreme Court now trying to preserve his right just simply not to have to promote homosexuality in the message that he puts on a cake, right? This is a direct parallel with what happened in Germany without the guns. They've done it this time without having to fire a shot.
And Kevin?
Anyways, this is my author's dedication, which is not really included in the book, but I'm praying for an American Renaissance. and a return to first principles. And to that point, I ask that may America and her people bless and affirm God and the moral and ethical covenant established between him and mankind through Israel over 3,400 years ago at Mount Sinai. It is God's express wish that all men guard their personal dignity and the dignity of their fellow man. This is achieved through the founding of honest weights and measures and a moral and healthy sexual constitution, the two pillars of any human civilization. It is therefore that our book, The Pink Swastika, is firstly dedicated to the honor of God, creator of heaven and earth and giver of all life. Secondly, and furthermore, this book is dedicated to the dignity of man, into which our creator breathes a living soul or a spirit that speaks, so that no man should ever by his actions bring shame to either God, himself, or his brother, that in this regard we are truly our brother's keepers. So whereas we entreat God to bless America in all her endeavors, we must understand this is a reciprocal relationship. God blesses those who bless and affirm him in his ways. It is my passionate desire and wish that America regains her spiritual vision and sense of true cause. It is in this way only that God's countenance and life-giving sustenance will once again grace America's shores and reveal itself upon the faces of her people.
That was very powerful. And I want our listeners to know that the two websites that you can go to for more details are scottlively.net, scottlively.net, and also defendthefamily.com, defendthefamily.com. Thank you so much for being on our program today, both of you. I want you all to always remember for the rest of your lives that Jesus Christ is a far greater Savior than you are a sinner. I look forward to hearing from you and your questions for our guests tomorrow on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.